Hello and welcome to the No More Tech Podcast, the show about answering your tech questions. I'm Devendra Hardwar. I'm a technology editor at Engadget, and I podcast about movies and TV at Slash Film for the Slash Filmcast. And as you can imagine, I get a lot of tech questions, so the show is really just about answering some of the most common ones. And if you want to send me a question, you could just head to nomoretech.net, that's no with a K, and head to the Ask form in the menu there. And you can also email me at nomoretechpodcast@gmail.com. But the form is just a lot easier. Everything gets organized there. If you're feeling fancy, you can send me an audio recording of your question, either over email or linked through that form. If you're going to do that, please record a message with your phone. They have pretty good microphones these days. Or if you have a better microphone on your computer, you could also use that as well. So last week, I kicked off the show by talking about Black Friday, just because I was getting so many of those questions. I hope everybody was able to find a good deal on what they wanted, and I hope you restrained yourself like I suggested. I actually ended up picking up a couple things. That iPad deal that I was talking about for $250 was a really great deal. And honestly, having a household iPad, even though I've reviewed a bunch of them and a lot of Android tablets, having one that I actually own, that's a bit new. I think iPads have just been way too expensive for me to even want to buy for a while. But I think it'll be useful. My parents always want to video chat with my baby Sophia, and having a nice large screen, that's going to let her see them more clearly too. So it's going to be a lot better than just video chatting with my phone. A couple other things. I picked up the Lenovo Smart Display. That's the one with Google Assistant. And I'm probably just going to put that in my kitchen, but that was a great deal too. That was $100 for the 8-inch model. And also, I believe the Google Home Display was also that price. So some really good deals around that. I know there are privacy concerns, but I think having a nice little screen that's voice-controlled in your kitchen could be super useful for pulling up recipes or just, you know, video chatting or watching something while you're cooking. That's definitely my plan. And this week, I really want to center on a question I got from Raja, who says, I know nothing about computers. I kinda just want an overview of how a computer works. For example, what do the different hardware components do? What is the difference between M.2 versus SATA versus NVMe and things like that? So to answer this question, I'm going to bring on my good friend, Duane DeFreitas. We went to college together. We've podcasted together at the Drill Down podcast. He's just an all-around great dude, but also a really smart guy about tech. And we actually, every day, end up chatting back and forth about our new hardware and things like that. So let's bring him on. Duane DeFreitas, what is a computer?
It's a machine, and it basically is a machine that can take information out and output answers. It takes in data, and it uses its processor to effectively apply computer programming requests to that data, and then you get an output based on that. They've been around forever, theoretically. Abacus is, like you said, off mic, and then you know, Charles Babbage had a difference engine, and he was creating an analytical engine. The difference engine was more of a calculator. The analytical engine was the first design for a general computer, right?
And so, yeah. So basically, a computer, any machine that runs computations. I think the main thing, you mentioned the abacus, right? And that is the idea of a computer, the idea of machines helping us do work and run computations is something that's been around for a long time, but it's been mostly analog, right? We've had abacuses. There were other calculators before, I think digital calculators. It was all kind of manual in a way. And then there was the move towards, I think, building computers, and that was using things like vacuum tubes, using physical things to create these machines and to let them do work.
And it's even worth noting that before we called computers, we called people computers. The moon landing was calculated in large part by a group of people that they called computers, mostly women at the time. And that's a big thing. But when we talk about computers today, a big thing is storing, retrieving, and processing data. That's kind of the big shift that happened right after the space race, right? The ability for the machine to do that, to do those three big things.
I guess the tough thing today is that's basically everything, isn't it?
Yes. That's pretty much
all our devices, yeah.
If you're looking at something on Engadget or you're looking at something in the electronics section of Amazon, chances are it is a computerized version of whatever existed before. You know, everything from your home appliances, like your washing machine and your clothes washer and your refrigerator, all the way over to your light bulbs. And then, of course, to your Windows or Macintosh machine and obviously your telephone. But their computers are everywhere today.
Mm-hmm. And Raja was asking, you know, kind of how does a computer work? What's the basic overview of one? And Dwayne, I think you're the best person for me to chat about this with, because that was our first thing when I first met you in college. Yeah. That was the thing we kind of bonded over.
Absolutely.
And we're still doing that thing of like comparing, contrasting, and talking about our gear. Mm-hmm. In a way, because I don't know, they were like extensions of ourselves, because we were both building computers and in love with our computers.
It was the hobby. It was the huge hobby.
It was. Well, and it wasn't even like it was super widespread. It was just like a really funny thing we both had in common, I think.
Indeed.
How would you describe like the basics of a computer, and where would you start?
So you start with the brain, right? The microprocessor or the CPU. And that's the brains. It sits on the motherboard, which is basically a huge PCB that connects all the various components together. Mm-hmm. The CPU is definitely the brains. And then there's other components. You want to go ahead with the next ones?
Yeah, I'll go. So, and this, by the way, as we're going down all this is pretty much what's in every single device. Even if it's something simple like a kid's toy, like they all have these basic components.
Leapfrog, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So there is RAM or memory. And you can think of that as determining how much your computer can do at once. So mm-hmm. if you have a really powerful PC, but a really tiny amount of RAM, or if you have a really powerful CPU and not much RAM, you'll notice your computer isn't very fast. And if you have an old computer and you throw a lot of, just a little more RAM in there, you'll probably notice a big speed difference. So I like to describe this as, RAM is the highway.
Yep.
That kind of allows your computer to do things. And if you add more lanes to that highway, all of a sudden your computer can do a lot more, even if the CPU itself hasn't changed.
If you're going to compare it to like a person's mind, RAM is like your kind of frontal lobe, your ability to do a couple things at once, right? Your ability to kind of manage bigger thoughts. And the highway analogy is perfect, or subway trains or whatever. The more lanes you got, the more rails you got, the better you can. And I don't know if you can update a lot of RAM in today's products, but I know back in the early 2000s when we were hanging out, that's what you did. I remember I had a gig of RAM and it was like, whoa.
It was a pretty big deal. The downside of like our modernized tech with all the unibody cases and like sealed batteries and stuff is like, in addition to making things thinner and sleeker and nicer, you can't do much. So if you have a MacBook Air, you can't really upgrade that down the line once it gets a little, gets a little out of date or something. I think the MacBook Pros you could still do stuff with, but it's
a lot
not
of work.
As much as you used to. The next important bit I'd say is storage.
Yes.
And if RAM is your memory that, lets you juggle multiple tasks, storage is just like, where can you park all this data, all this work that you're doing? That's through disk drives. It used to be mechanical disk drives, and now it's mostly SSDs or solid state disk drives.
Right.
And that was a big change, but
it was a huge change. Mm-hmm. Back in the day, for a long time it was like ticker tape, but the hard drive was this idea where you could use these magnetic headers to write on a disk, right? A circular disk. The advent of solid state drives was huge because, I mean, DaVinci was talking about how RAM affects your speed, your response time. There was a time when RAM was doing really well. People had a lot of it and people had reasonable CPU speed, but the hard drives, writing everything that the computer did down, took forever. And so there were a whole bunch of steps moving from parallel to serial, moving from hard disk to solid state. And all that stuff has helped computers become both fast and thin and light.
Yeah, it used to be actually, I remember what was big in the 90s and the early aughts were RAM disks.
Like, yes, I had one of those.
Yeah, and people would try to just carve out a little bit of their RAM because it's so much faster than your actual disk drive. And you use that for storage. And we're probably getting a little confusing now. But I think that sort of mentality is what led to the move towards SSDs, right? Where
solid-state
storage got a lot better and cheaper and easier to implement, too. And I think Raja, he asked specifically the difference between M.2, SATA, and NVMe. That's getting a little more in the weeds. But I think It's a thing we're thinking about right now, too, because I just rebuilt my PC and I had to like look up some of these topics and make sure what I was buying was like actually supported by my motherboard and also, you know, the best stuff I could get at the time.
Would it give you the performance, the response that you're looking for, right?
Right.
Today, I think with a lot of those specific differentiations between those three the types of devices you just said, interfaces.
It's not even three different types. But yeah, I could get more into that. So SATA mm-hmm. is kind of what we've been connecting hard drives to or with for, I'd say, a decade now. I remember when I had like the older parallel ports, and those were really annoying. But SATA is like a single port, a single nice thin cable.
Serial ATA.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was the old, yeah.
It's a serial AT attachment as opposed to the old parallel AT attachment, right? So
yeah, and parallel was like this ugly cable. It was like 18 pins or something. And you had to get it in just right. Right.
And don't break now a pin, or else you have to buy a new drive.
Thin data cable. You have like one data cable. You have one nice little power cable, and you just plug them in. And so easy to wrap them around your case now. Man, the days of parallel were just not great. But SATA, yeah, we've had that for a while now. We've gone through mechanical disk drives and then SSDs on that. And now the new thing is NVMe. And that's really interesting because I think I just haven't paid much attention to that tech, I guess, over the past 4 or 5 years. So as I went about upgrading my system, I really had to look into this myself, too. And these things are super cool. If you have a recent laptop, that's probably, and it's a good laptop, not like the bargain one, that's most likely the SSD that's in there. It looks like a stick of RAM. And now things are getting really confusing because now, yeah, the actual memory chips look more like RAM and they plug in right into the PCIe bus, and that is like the main
the word bus is, it says what it is, like that's the main kind of route between of information between the processor, the CPU and the external components, so
all the different components.
So when you have NVMe, it's a faster way to connect to the various components, which means you get more response time.
Yeah, just faster data flow in general. It also means you don't, I think right now solid state has just gotten so fast, it's a bit limited by what SATA can do.
Yes.
So right now you can find SSDs in both SATA format, and those are the slightly bigger SSDs. Those are the ones that look like old laptop drives. We call them 2.5-inch drives. And also, surprisingly, you can find SATA drives that also connect onto the motherboard or... they look like NVMe drives. It's getting a little confusing. NVMe itself is that whole new concept of plugging the storage right into the motherboard there.
Yep.
That really saves a lot of space for mini computers and notebooks and things like that. But I also have it on my giant mid-tower desktop, which seems like overkill. But the benefit there is that you get faster data throughput for large files. And I think that's the important thing. So that's like video editing. That's like audio editing. Loading maps for games, that's where you really see the advantage of NVMe. I put my OS on my NVMe drive, but I just reading about it now, that seems like maybe a little overkill. Yeah,
well, you look good. I like it. I like putting, because all those files are moving quickly, left and right, back and forth. So, you know, if you're going to have power, you might as well put it there. I don't know. Unless it takes up too much space. I don't think it does, right? So
it doesn't take up much space. It's just more, these drives are super expensive. Mm-hmm. It is much more economical to buy a standard SATA SSD. We saw some good deals. I think like the terabyte ones are getting super cheap now.
Yeah.
This is like where we were with the move towards SSD and older mechanical drives, and those can store like 4 terabytes of data now easily and be like super cheap. So we're kind of seeing that difference again.
Exactly. So if you've got if you're building a computer, you know, you've got your CPU, right? You've got your RAM, and then you might have a SATA drive or an NVMe drive that's going to hold kind of your these files, like Steve Venture was talking about, for game maps or whatever. But then maybe you have storage. You have a bunch of music files or something. Mm-hmm. That's going to sit on that physical hard disk, right? 4 terabytes, whatever. Or maybe you have attached storage, like a Drobo or something.
Yeah, so or an external, something like that.
Exactly.
So we're getting deep in the weeds here. But I think what is really interesting, Raja also mentioned M.2. And just to be clear, M.2 is a specific form factor of NVMe. So that's like, it's just like, it's describing like the specific pins. And if you're buying an NVMe SSD, you better make sure your motherboard can support that particular, style.
Exactly.
That's the main thing. And honestly, so I think building a computer has gotten a lot much easier than it used to be. But you still have to know these little things, like make sure you're getting the right SSD drive. Make sure you're getting the right type of RAM, because we're up to DDR4 now, but also if you have an older system, you may still be running DDR3. It's all kind of confusing. Yeah.
Exactly. Now, after all that, we still have the video card, right? Want to talk about that?
That's a whole thing, right? So the video card handles your graphics processing. And if you think about, I think the best way to describe this is, like, look at your video game consoles, right? They're doing much more than I think a typical computer or, you know, a set-top box normally does. And that's because they have really nice, juicy graphics processing.
Juicy. I like that. I like juicy.
Provided by AMD, you know, and that's what allows 3D models. It's what it allows those really nice looking games. The thing is, most CPUs now also have onboard video, which means that if you plug a CPU into your computer, you'll still be able to just plug in a monitor and like get to work, but you probably won't be able to play many games with that hardware.
This is most notable on some high-end laptops. So if you get yourself a MacBook Pro or a high-end HP, when you're on battery, the system will choose to use the video processor, video adapter that is built in with the CPU. And then if you plug in and you load up a game or something, because of the available electricity, the available power, the system will then flip over to a card that is doing graphics processing based on something more discrete, like a NVIDIA or AMD. This is just so basically you can save power when you're on the road versus when you get home and you want to like juice it up and do some video editing or whatever.
And honestly, graphics cards are getting super exciting now. I'm going to talk more about those, I think, in a future episode.
They're computers in their own right, right?
They're computers in their own right. Like right now, people are using, GPUs or graphics processors for major computing tasks. So things like encoding video.
Self-driving cars.
Yeah, self-driving cars, parallel processing tasks. And that's a whole like longer explanation, but it has to do with the way GPUs handle and process data compared to CPUs. And GPUs are just better at doing, I think, multiple things at once.
Yeah.
And specific types of workflows like that, like just big, meaty workflows. GPUs are really good at that. So it's a really interesting time. I just reviewed the NVIDIA RTX 2080 Ti, which is the fastest and most powerful consumer level GPU on the market right now. That thing is incredible. Go read my Engadget review of that there, because you can basically run games in 4K over 60 frames per second. And that is...
It's a lot of power.
It's like the holy grail of what gamers have been asking for forever. By the way, with all the graphic settings turned all the way up, I'm very excited about this thing. It makes games like Hitman 2 just look like insane. Yeah.
So what's really cool about the graphics adapters and gaming is that a lot of people say, well, it's so silly to spend all this money or whatever on games. But if you look at the history of modern computing, go back to the 80s, the Wolfenstein 3D, these graphics adapters have pushed gaming software hard. And so gaming software then comes out that requires more power. And then the graphic adapter gets pushed harder. And it got to a point where someone like NVIDIA said, we're building basically spare no expense mini supercomputers. What if we put them all together and applied them to the kinds of tasks that you mentioned earlier, Dimitri, whether it's, folding, looking at proteins for cancer cures or self-driving cars or, you know, AI or whatever. That's what's so cool. Gaming has actually driven a large part of the supercomputing revolution.
It's surprising. And also like the whole like Bitcoin and digital currency revolution too, which that's the downside of all this, because last year when Bitcoin and all those things got really popular, people were just hoarding all the GPUs and making them super expensive and buying them everywhere. And apparently they're also ruining the environment.
Yes.
Crunching.
There's a lot of electricity and most of the electricity is coming from a coal-fired power plants. What's really interesting is, and this was stopped almost as soon as it started, but I read a story about a guy who got himself a Tesla Model X. And what he did was he built a GPU-based Bitcoin mining operation, the system. He built that into the Model X.
Oh,
why did he do this? So he could go to the supercharger. You know, Tesla has these free quick charging stations around the country. And they're free if you bought your car earlier in Tesla's history. And the Model X is one of the vehicles that got access to that free pumping of electricity. So he would drive the car up, he'd plug it into the supercharger, and it basically take advantage of the car's 90 kilowatt battery and have it constantly being topped up so he could mine Bitcoin. It was an operation that saved him, you know, $80,000 for the car, but it's
killing that power, like that whole power zone.
Exactly. So he basically, and when Tesla realized that this one vehicle was using so much power, like, what are you doing? And so it got stopped. But I mean, it was an ingenious scheme.
This is what hackers do, right? So
exactly.
You give a hacker hardware, and that's where they'll hack it all up. I think let's move beyond video cards. The last thing I want to mention is sound. And that's the thing where, yeah, that's also just like video. It's pretty much all integrated into the motherboard these days. So it's not on the CPU typically, but it's usually something that's integrated right there. So you could plug in, if you build a computer, you don't need a sound card anymore. You can just plug in your speakers directly to the motherboard. Sound cards are still around, and I think they're still really interesting. Professionals really like them.
I love mine.
Which one do you have?
I have a Sound Blaster, like whatever they're making these days. I forgot
the
exact
external
name. It's external, yeah. Okay. So I plug it in. When I plug my machine in, my laptop in, I get access to that. And that's kind of how I do a lot of my recording and stuff. But, I mean, when we talk about these cards, right, we used to call them daughter boards because there was a motherboard. And what's really interesting is that each daughter board is effectively a series of computer components unto itself that's going to talk to the motherboard.
So a daughter board is something that plugs into the motherboard, and sound cards used to connect over PCI and older connectors as well, yeah.
So when we say card, PCIe, that's the interface instead of like, you know, the old school stuff. But yeah, so all these cards are theoretically daughters to the larger motherboard. And they all theoretically, in many cases, like the sound cards and video cards, they have their own RAM. They have their own processing. And they're trying to take weight processing load off of the central processing unit, the computer processing unit, the CPU, in order to have your experience and your response time with your system be better.
Mm-hmm. I think so. For music professionals, having a dedicated sound card is super useful. But also, I think the main thing for gamers and a lot of people is I liked having a separate amp. Sound cards typically have higher quality amps. If you have good speakers, and I've had good speakers on my PC since I built my first one in college. I had the Klipsch Pro Media 2.1s back then, upgraded to the Logitech. What was it, the Z680s?
The 680s, exactly.
That we both loved. And right now I have these ceramic speakers from, who's this designer? Joey something or other. But the speakers are ceramic. The sub is ceramic. So you kind of want to have like a good high quality audio processor for that. The thing is, my motherboard sound is pretty good now. Like, it's good enough where even a good pair of speakers will be fine without a sound card.
Joey Roths, right?
I do have the Joey Roths. That's what it is. Mm-hmm. If you have really good headphones that require a lot of power, you could get a sound card to do that, either a card that you plug in or something that plugs in externally over USB. Or honestly, maybe just kind of get an amp and see if that can help you. You could put that between the computer headphone jack and, you know, the actual headphones themselves. There's a lot of ways to go through it. If you kind of want to upgrade your sound and you have good headphones, I really like the AudioQuest Dragonflies. They're these cool little DACs or digital audio converters. They're cool little headphone amps. They plug into straight into USB, and then they have like a little headphone jack on the other side. So it's about the size of a flash drive, and it's super great.
I'm just excited that there's a headphone jack.
It has a headphone jack. All hail the headphone jack. The thing you will find on most computers these days, are headphone jacks and 3.5 millimeter ports. I'm still very sad that we're seeing them disappearing on phones for no goddamn reason.
Yeah, it's
like,
so
for
you
no
can
reason at all.
Yeah, I completely agree with you, especially because there is a time when I'll be sitting in a cafe with my computer and my headphones, and then I close my laptop. And I'll get up and I want to plug my headphones directly into my telephone and enter the dongle, right?
Oh. The dongle. I mean, now exactly. We can do all this wirelessly too, which is nice. And I love wireless headphones. It's just
there's room for that. But then you have to switch. If you're using wireless headphones to listen to your computer and then you want to listen to your phone, you've got to, I mean, if you have one of those fancy Apple ones, you can do a quick switch, but otherwise you have to kind of unpair and repair. And more important,
unpair and repair. Yeah.
You have to also charge these things up. So it's one more thing to charge. So I see why people are upset at the lack of the headphone jack. I understand.
I just find it hilarious that Apple gives people headphones with the iPhones, so they're the Lightning headphones, which cannot connect to any of Apple's computers.
Right.
How hilarious is that?
And they can't connect to the new iPad as well.
Yep.
Right.
Because so if you have USB-C, which is a good change, but yeah.
There's no headphone jack on the new iPad. So you have to get a dongle that goes from Lightning to USB-C if you want to connect those Apple headphones into your iPad. And then you have to get another dongle that goes from Lightning to headphone jack if you want to connect to your Mac laptop. So yeah, it's a bit of a mess right now. We'll see how things clear up.
So that's all basically, I think, the main hardware sketches. If you look at like a smartphone, if you look at a tablet, even like smaller devices, it's kind of all, you could break down a computer into all these things. The other thing we haven't really mentioned is software. And do want to talk about that briefly. You may hear things like firmware and operating systems. And what is firmware, Dwayne? Like how would you explain that super quickly?
So firmware is, when you've got a computer, you've got your operating system, you've got your hardware and everything. Each bit of hardware has basically, it's got hardware instructions that help it deal better with talking to the general system. Mm-hmm. And firmware updates are updates to that underlying hardware driver system that allow it to work better.
Yeah.
They're basically embedded systems inside of each component, and each component's embedded systems are designed to work as well as possible, but sometimes the developers realize there's a better way to do it. And so when they do that, they issue a firmware update. Firmware updates used to be the most frightening thing ever. You know, make sure everything's plugged in, make sure that there's not going to be a power outage.
Like now, if you do the firmware update for anything, even like a pair of headphones, it's like, make sure it's plugged in. Don't touch anything. Don't reset your computer, you know. Otherwise, you could brick your entire device.
Exactly. So, yeah, it's firmware is one of those things where you should keep up on it. And a good component or a good router or a good any product really will let you know when there's a firmware update, and it will walk you through how to do it properly. It's one of those things, though, where you need to follow the instructions to the letter.
Yeah. And what's funny now is like even our TVs have software updates in general, but sometimes it's firmware, sometimes it's just the OS. So the other bit of software we talk about a lot is operating systems, and that's what's run. Those run on top of all the hardware, and they kind of tell your computer what to do. So that's that you're running Windows most likely if you have a PC. You're running Mac OS on Mac. Some people like to run Linux. Operating systems it used to be a lot more confusing, I think, and it used to be a lot more difficult, but now things have pretty much settled in a good way. So speaking of hardware, let's move to this next question from Ryan, who asks, I currently have an old Acer Chromebook and I'm looking to upgrade. It still runs fine, but I want something with more RAM and something that will let me run Steam, all for the cheapest possible price. Would you recommend?
So it's cool that he's asking about more RAM, because we just went over why more RAM is important. You know, he wants better responses when he's going to do something. Steam running on Chrome. I'd like to see that. I haven't seen that yet.
Well, I think I see your suggestion here, Dwayne. It is a good option, but we'll talk more about that. So if he's running for Steam, though, that immediately signals to me not Chromebook.
Exactly.
Chromebook. 100%
no Chromebook.
PC.
The difference is that a Chromebook is, it's a laptop that's got a Linux situation in the background, and Chrome, the browser, is pretty much the entire interface, right? Whereas, and so Chrome as a platform does work well in many ways, because Chrome, it has a whole bunch of extensions which basically function as apps, and you can use that. But if you want to play games,
most of us just live in our browsers now anyway.
Exactly.
Too, right? So, yeah.
But if you want to play games, you want Steam, you're going to need something with a bit more, a platform that's a bit more versatile. And that's where Windows comes in.
Windows is the best
platform for Steam, no doubt.
The thing I would recommend, by the way, is if you want a cheap gaming computer, we are in a great time of gaming computers. I've covered a couple of them at Engadget, but the one I really like, Dell, a couple years ago, introduced the Inspiron 7000 Gaming, I believe. And this was a gaming laptop that started around $700 to $800. You'd often find it on sale. Now they've rebranded their gaming line as the Dell G series, and the Dell G3 is a really nice, inexpensive machine. So look at that. There's the G3, the G5, and the G7. Really, like, they've done a good job of just getting the hardware down quite a bit, and they still include, like, decent NVIDIA graphics. So, like, either the NVIDIA GTX 1050 or 1060. So you'll be able to run games in 1080p over 60 FPS, which is kind of what we've wanted. It's what I've wanted in PC gaming for the past decade. Now you can get it on the cheap on your laptop. So that's my main recommendation there. But what do you recommend for another, if he wants a separate Chromebook down the line?
If you want a separate Chromebook, then I think it's worth going straight to Google, right? Google does make the OS, and the Google Pixel Book is a pretty good option, right? It's got, you're talking about you wanted more RAM. You can configure it with either 8 gigs or 16 gigs. I would always go for 16 just because if you're going to have it for a long time, knowing how Chrome can eat up RAM, that's the way to go. it's pretty small. It's got the 12.3-inch screen, and it's got good resolutions, 2400 by 1600. And it's got a touchscreen, which is nice. And the storage goes up to half a gigabyte. What, so half a terabyte.
Right? Like, it's a pretty expensive Chromebook, though, isn't it?
It is an expensive Chromebook. That's no deal. But I feel like what you're getting, it's $700.
Yeah.
And to just put a finer point on what Sphinx said about the G series, you can get a 15-inch Dell G3 gaming laptop for $750.
Man.
So for $750, I would say your money's probably better spent on the gaming laptop. It's 15 inches. It's not 12.3. But for a bit more heft, you're going to have a lot more versatility. And it sounds like, you know, when it comes to bang for your buck, you can't go wrong with that.
Mm-hmm. And philosophically, I'll just say, like, you'll hear me say this on the show quite a bit. Chromebooks are fine. I think they're decent machines, but they're best when they're cheap. That's the whole point of it. I don't understand the point of spending over $500 for a machine that is still basically a web browser, no matter how much it can do, you know, and that's the main thing. They're getting better, at least, like, now they can run Android apps. They're better at multitasking. I think Google's just making it a more robust platform. But they still don't know how to do a lot of things. Like, we just reviewed the
Pixel
Slate.
That's almost on purpose, right? Like, they don't do a lot of things on purpose because they're trying to keep the experience lean.
But it's really confusing, though. They just announced and released the Pixel Slate, which we reviewed at Engadget, and that is a garbage machine. That is, first of all, Chrome OS is such a desktop-focused, OS. Why would you put that on a tablet when you haven't built anything for touchscreen? It's super expensive. That's a whole thing. That's probably a longer rant.
Yeah.
Let's move on to our next question from Kyle Kizu, who says, I'm getting a bit sick of MacBooks and was looking to get something cheaper than $1,000, but with nearly equal speed and similarly... but with nearly equal speed and similarly easy to interact with... my computer lingo is awful here. I love thin designs, but don't love black colors. I do a lot of writing and some Photoshop and Illustrator work, and it would ideally be 250 gigabytes or more. What would you recommend there, Dwayne? Have anything in mind?
I like the HP Spectres. I like them a lot. I think HP has done a beautiful job. I had an Envy for like 7 years. I loved it. But yeah, you get a lot of computer. They come in colors like, you know, a magnesium style, kind of silvery kind of thing, you know, that you can get them in different, or black or whatever. I know you don't like black, but you know, you can do that. But at the same time, I also think that they're, you know, for the money, they're actually pretty good. And the design is quite beautiful. So you can get one of those. And then I think also you can get, Dell has a couple of options in the, I think the XPS 13 range that you can get your hands on.
I think the XPS 13, like, that
for...
is, look at that computer. I think that's a fantastic ultra portable, man. And it, they look amazing, and you can get them. I bought my brother one like 2 years ago for $800, and it was on sale, but still. I do like the Spectres quite a lot, Dwayne. They tend to start at $1,000, so you'd have to look for sales or something to get it under this budget. But these are all, like, the thing is, PCs, and especially ultra-portables, have gotten really good. Don't be afraid of a PC.
The XPS 13 Developer Edition is at, it's down to $890 right now. And it usually hangs out around like $980. But if you want a machine that's going to be fairly powerful, you're going to be spending about $1,000, right? Between $800 and $1,000, I want to say. Unless you're going to get one of those Dell gaming laptops. And the reason for that is the Dell gaming laptops, they haven't focused on making it thin and light. And that's kind of where some of the expense comes in. Materials, thin and light. So
they're around 4.5 to 5 pounds, which you can live with if you just want cheap gaming, you know. I think the XPS 13, though, is probably just look at that. Go to a store, like feel it, look at it. For writing Photoshop and Illustrator, it's going to be fine. You don't really need a GPU for a lot of those tasks. But you can, I think, spec some of those things up. I think the 15-inch you can spec up with a decent GPU if you have the extra budget for that.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, definitely.
Next question, Denise Schreiber asks, where do you see Mac in 5 to 10 years? Will creatives, film, graphics, design, etc., abandon it, or is the negativity overblown? I'm sure you have some thoughts here, Dan.
Wow. So I spend a lot of time talking to a guy who works in the creative arts with a Mac. You know him, Devinger. His name is Andy. And he does, you know, basically audio editing and processing for a significant amount of Disney properties. And one of the things that he complains about the most as an expert is the Mac Pro. Right, this is the desktop machine that's supposed to be for creative development. And it used to be the old trash can or steampunk Mac, kind of the big fancy grill on the front. You can open up the side and change the components that we spoke about earlier on the show. You used to be able to do that. But they came out with this kind of circular, like dustbin kind of Mac, and you can do nothing but plug things into it. And he thinks that that is the worst thing ever. And it's completely, for a professional machine, it's completely unupgradable. And that's a problem because professional machines are ones where you need to be able to get under the hood and do what you need to do to customize it to your needs. That said, Apple has kind of mentioned that that was a mistake. And I think we might see more, let's call it open or the more the ability to get into those kind of super professional machines and have professionals do what they want to do. When it comes to MacBooks, like the laptops, MacBook Pros or whatever, I mean, I think a lot of people can look at the 2016's MacBook Pro 13-inch and say that there's nothing pro about that MacBook.
Not at all. You have four USB-C ports exactly. And nothing professional can connect to them. You have, oh man, that keyboard.
Yeah.
I hate the flat keyboard Apple is going to. Using the 13 right now, the MacBook Pro 13. There's no travel to it. It's like tapping on glass. It just like kills me.
Yeah, I actually had to put a keyboard. It's like a flat silicone cover over the keyboard of my MacBook Pro 15 just to give it that much more travel.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah, it does. It works really well. You can still close your laptop. It's fine. You wouldn't even notice it's there. And if you spill something, you're in better shape than you would be otherwise. But I think you're absolutely right. So Apple has kind of gone through this phase of everything must be thinner, lighter, cleaner, simpler. And that has moved away from, I think, the utility that professionals desire in their machine. So Apple's going to have to find a way to make that work. On many cases, many people, you know, a John Gruber might say, well, when Apple makes the move to USB-C for everything, then every other system, every other company will have to follow, and that'll make things simpler. And you know, maybe there's an argument there, but we won't see that for a while. I think in 10 years, Apple's going to have to basically make it so that professionals feel more comfortable and more stable, really. You can't change ports all the time. You can't do that all the time. If you want professionals to be able to plug in their specialized products and use them with the Mac platform. That said, Mac OS is a powerful OS. And I think the discussion that happened during the last Apple event that Mac OS and iOS will not be merged, that Mac OS will remain a general computing platform, that gives people some hope. So, I mean, what do you think, Devendra?
It is super disappointing, I think, on multiple levels in terms of what Apple's doing now. They've always been a company that tends to tell their users what they want, you know, rather than responding to what users want. So I think that mentality has gone full tilt since Steve Jobs passed away, unfortunately. And it's a very different company now. Like, they don't think as much about what users actually want or need. And I don't think they think very practically either. So, like, that shift towards the new MacBooks, they're very pretty, but I like to look at them. I don't like to hold them. I don't like to use them.
They're also delicate, right? So that's another thing.
They feel delicate, yeah. There's a touch bar, which is a weird, just like a very strange new piece of hardware. I don't think it's very useful. I know some people like it. Just not a fan. It kills me what they did to the keyboard. But looking at what they're doing with laptops in general, right? The new MacBook Air is such a disappointment.
It's the same thing as the MacBook Pro 13. If you look at, I wrote a piece on how it's really hard to choose which one you want, the MacBook Pro 13 with no touch bar or the MacBook Air. It's the most beloved Mac, the MacBook Air. Everybody bought it for a long time, so they had to make a new version. Yeah.
The MacBook Pro 13 is the real successor to that old MacBook Air, basically. But yeah, so the new MacBook has a seriously underpowered processor. not, you know, even fewer ports to work with. We kind of expected that. But it's really all about chasing the super thin design. And it just seems like, I don't know, it seems like a fool's errand. You know, like our computers are getting so thin, except they are doing less. And that kind of ties into the mentality of dropping the headphone jack, too. Like, you're doing it maybe for stylistic reasons. Sure, it may get you some extra battery life. Sure, it may make it easier to, you know, weatherproof and waterproof your phones. But you're losing...
Not a concern with a computer. You're not...
Not a concern with a computer.
Typing your computer in the rain. You know what's interesting, Devendra? Mm-hmm. Back when Tim Cook first took over, the first Retina Max, the MacBook Pro 15... MacBook Pro 15 Retina, I think mm-hmm. it was 2012. That was the first MacBook that had an HDMI port. Remember that? It was like, whoa, yeah. Apple put an HDMI port in and nobody thought that was going to happen. So there was this moment when they had, you know, their, you know, the first Thunderbolt plus normal USBs plus a little slot to put your SD cards in and this HDMI port. And it had everything. And you were like, yes, finally we're there. Mm-hmm. And then they just complete reversal.
Step backwards. Exactly. Yeah. Who needs the most useful ports around right now? Not professionals. So 5 to 10 years, the main question here. I do think Apple's going to keep doubling down on this idea of simplifying consumer hardware. So this new MacBook Air, I think, is a good example where they sacrificed a ton of power, a ton of CPU processing for design, for like aesthetics. And who knows, like probably a lot of Apple consumers, the people who just kind of stroll into an Apple store and want the prettiest thing on the shelf, it'll probably appeal to them. I think there's going to be a bigger disconnect between the professional world and Apple. But if they actually live up to what they're saying with this new MacBook Pro, or sorry, the new Mac Pro, maybe they can create this device that's sort of like, you know, a freaking PC where you can upgrade it down the line. Maybe they can build like a nice little shell that's a little DIY, right? That, you know, people for five years can upgrade the RAM, maybe upgrade a bit of storage, probably not upgrade the CPU.
It might be special Apple RAM so they can maintain their margins. That's a big thing.
No. We'll never see that again. That used to be a crazy thing. But I would like to see the ability open ports, basically. You know, so open PCIe ports, let people upgrade the GPUs, because look at how quickly NVIDIA is developing things. Look at how crazy fast that development is going. I think that's going to be the big thing. You got to open things back up for professionals.
As a stopgap, Apple did announce support coming for external GPUs, meaning you can put a GPU in certain enclosures and it should work on the Mac Pro, possibly even MacBook computers, laptops. So they're definitely moving in that direction. And I think this idea of a kind of breakout space where you can add PCI cards to Venture is a good one. I know that when I think of Johnny Ive and what he wants to do with things, he wants everything to be really compact and tiny. And
that's true.
And,
they did just announce the external GPU thing too.
So I like that. I like that a lot. The external GPU thing is helpful. So if there's a way to make a cute little box that you can put PCI cards in, then okay. Then we'll all live.
Or maybe like a fully modular system too, where Apple can sell you different parts, you know. And this is how we can get proprietary, right? Like an Apple-approved new powerful GPU that you just kind of slot in easily instead of just plugging in.
It's turnkey. Manually. Like you turn it in, flip it, and then you turn the other one out and flip it out and put the new one in or
like
something.
Like the Drobo thing or something.
Exactly. You know, exactly.
Kind of nice. So let's wind down with some quick questions now. Mike is asking, have we reached the point where cell phones are so good at everything we don't need to upgrade as often? Will this hinder technological advancements if sales slow as consumers don't upgrade as often? What do you think here, Dwayne? And we don't have to spend long on these questions.
Right. So this is a two-parter. And I would say for the first part, have we reached the point where cell phones are so good at everything that we don't need to upgrade often? The answer is yes. There was a time when I would upgrade my iPhone every year. And that was because they were pretty slow. And over time, you know, every new OS drop got harder and harder for the phone. But if you look at the new iOS 12, I have an iPhone 6S that actually, I don't use it as my default phone anymore, but it works better than it did under iOS 11. So two things are happening. One, the chips are getting fast enough to handle a couple years. And the hardware, whether it's Samsung or Google's Pixel or Apple's iPhones, you've got this hardware that is robust. It's made out of better materials, glass and steel in some cases, aluminum. And these things make it so that your phone doesn't just fall apart. On top of that, I think the operating systems are being built so that they're not so heavy on the graphical interface anymore. That's not changing so much. And the CPUs can keep up with the latest apps. So I think that there's a there's no reason to jump on the new phone every year. I think you can go to maybe even 3, maybe even 4 years at this point and be okay. And then you can put your money toward one of these expensive computers, laptops.
I would say, though, at least 2 years at this point. Like, I have an iPhone 10. At least. Mm-hmm. And the iPhone 10 is great. The 10S, slightly better camera, you know, much better processor, but not worth paying $1,000 for a phone again. So it's what's happened to the PC market is happening to the phone market.
Yes.
I don't think this is going to hinder. Yeah, it's maturing. I don't think this is going to hinder advancements. If anything, it's going to make these companies do more to impress us every couple generations. So what we're hearing next year is that people are going to be throwing in more than two cameras, like up to, what, 5 or 6? Right.
Didn't Amazon try that a long time ago? 7 cameras in their Amazon Fire Phone?
That was bad. That was, yes. They had like 3D cameras for a holographic display that was terrible. But now, like, more cameras, like more tech in there, I think things are going to get really interesting. What I'm really interested in is the folding phone concept and also the dual screen PC idea. And I think that's going to really change up what we consider mobile technology.
Yeah, I think if consumers are buying phones less, that simply means that phones have to do more to get consumers out there. They need the wow factor. This happened with television sets too. There was a time when television sets, you had one for 10, 15 years. And so they started doing, you know, HD came out, it was 720, and then it was 1080. Then we had the age of 3D TVs, which, you know, people didn't really buy into, but it was a moment where the industry said, we need to give them something to get their hands on that's going to excite them. So the 3D thing came out, and when that didn't work, they realized that 3D isn't the way, 4K is the way. And I think 4K is very successful. People recognize
it took a while, though. 4K wasn't just the way.
It did take a while. Yeah,
because it needed HDR, it needed other stuff to make it more useful.
And I think that's you're exactly right. And part of that was, okay, we've got 4K, it's not doing exactly what we wanted to do. So HDR, you know, and now with support for things like Atmos sound, all these things, that gets people moving, right? That gets people saying, okay, you know, finally I've got a TV I like, but I saw one in the store or I went over to my friend's house and it was so much better. So I think phones are going to have to be the same way. They're going to have to, if people slow down, and especially if these prices keep on going up, I mean, $1,000 for a phone is something to sneeze at.
That's kind of ridiculous. Really good, though, is that there are great phones available for much cheaper. So I think $500 and under. Look at what OnePlus is doing. Look at what Motorola is doing, honestly. Like, their Android
phones are pretty good. Motorola.
People have to get better at their camera technology, but in general, like, you know, I like the way cheap phones are going, and that's something I'm going to pay more attention to as well.
The last thing I'll say, speaking of the camera, you bring up a very good point. The post-processing on the image that the cameras take, that's, I think, where people get excited. I wasn't so keen on getting an iPhone XS, but I had a kid and I wanted a better camera, and what they're able to do with the exposure in the computers built into the phone once that picture's taken is incredible, right? That's incredible. And so
it's HDR tech today, by the way, in phones is mainly due to they're taking multiple photos, but also there's a lot of algorithmic work that's making your pictures look better. It's even more true in Google's Pixel phones because they only have one lens. I bought my wife the Pixel 3, and I love it for baby photos. Everything just looks kind of perfect.
Oh,
maybe
yeah.
Too perfect at times, but it looks really good.
Well, your kid's perfect, so you can't get too perfect.
Except when she doesn't sleep at night. But you know how that goes, Dwayne?
I do.
Yeah. So we have one more question, but actually I think I'm going to save it for a future episode because we're getting kind of long in time here. Dwayne, thank you so much for joining me and answering some tech questions.
Absolutely.
Where can people find you on the internet these days?
Check me out on Twitter.com/DwayneD, DWAYNED. You can also check out DwayneD.com, and you can see my recent thoughts about the MacBook Air and the MacBook Pro on GeeksOfDoom.com. All right.
Excellent. And you do a podcast there too, right?
That's true. I kind of forgot. every week on Friday, you can hear me talk with a couple other guys about technology. We drill down deep into the biggest stories of the week. That's called The Drill Down. It's also on Geeks of Doom.
Yeah, I used to do the Drill Down podcast as well, so I'm an alumna of that. That podcast has been around for so long, has an illustrious array of people who've been on it, so go check that out. You can find me on Twitter at @Devendra, and I write about tech and gadget. I podcast about movies and TV at slashfilm.com, at the slashfilmcast there. You can send us questions for this podcast at nomoretechpodcast@gmail.com. Our website is nomoretech.net. And by the way, that's KNOW. I like the pun there because it's also like, please, please no more. Please make it stop. KNOW tech, nomoretech.net. You can ask a question through the web form there, or also just keep an eye on, you know, when episodes are coming up. Please subscribe. Please leave us a review. And let me know if you have any questions. I'm Devendra Hardwar, signing off.